Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's January 16, 2013, and this is episode 357. And for those of you that also listen to the TWIP or This Week in Photo podcast, you'll already know today's guest, Don Komarechka. Don is a nature photographer from Ontario, Canada, who, in addition to his beautiful landscape work, specializes in photographing amazing snowflakes. Welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you very much for having me, Martin.
You're very welcome. It's we've met and talked a couple of times on TWIP, and I mean, that's always a lot of fun. But I'm looking forward to sort of getting you to myself today and talking a little bit about your photography, your landscape work, your snowflakes and everything, because they are fascinating, and I'm going to pick your brains a little bit about that later.
And one of the things that I love to do with my photography is share all of my secrets. And I find that if I can learn something new about photography just by experimenting and having fun, the value in somebody looking at that particular photograph and taking something away and trying it themselves, that makes me feel a whole heck of a lot better about what I'm doing too. So it's one of the things that I always shout out. If I post something that I've created something new on, I'll post a behind the scenes picture or answer all the questions. And when you ask me to be on the podcast here, and I was like, this is great, because I like to have any avenue to share all of these secrets and tips and all this fun stuff that I can. So thank you very much for having me.
Not at all. I mean, I know that the listeners are gonna enjoy listening to this, and I'm totally with you. I mean, sharing is what it's all about these days, and the more we can do of that, the better off the world is going to be, I'm sure.
Agreed.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. When did you decide photography was your thing and all of that?
Well, let's see. I bought my first camera about 5 years ago, a little bit over 5 years ago now. And prior to that, I did not have any real interest in photography. So it sort of snuck up on me.
Yeah.
I'll give you a bit of a backstory here. My father used to be quite into photography, and he was like the classic high school camera geek, in the dark room putting together the yearbook and that kind of stuff. And he always had a love for it, and he actually wanted to pursue it professionally. But my grandfather, his dad, pretty much said no. There's no money in that. You can't get a reliable, stable income. Go put your educational efforts into something that can get you a good job. And he ended up having a great job. His best job was like installing mining communication equipment all over the world. He had a wonderful career, but it was nothing photography related. And he always had a love for it, and he never really got to explore it as much as he wanted. He's since passed on. And a couple of years ago, before he passed away, he gave me an envelope with sort of a living will inside of it and said, you know what, go out and buy something that you'll enjoy. I just want to see you enjoy something. And without really thinking too much about it, I went out and I bought a camera. And it helped the two of us bond. And my parents had been divorced for a while, so I wasn't all that close. And sort of rekindled that relationship. And he taught me everything he knew, which sparked photography with me. And prior to that, I've always been sort of science-minded, trying to figure out why the world works the way it does, how certain things are, and doing all sorts of high-voltage experiments or just fun stuff as a kid that helped me figure all that stuff out. And pair that with photography, and the two together work beautifully when I explore the world of macro photography, and especially snowflakes this time of the year, and some of the advanced techniques that I use for photographing landscapes and that kind of stuff. It all comes together, and I'm able to use those photographic skills to sort of pursue my dream of just exploring the world and why it works.
That's incredible. I've heard you on TWIP. It wasn't one where I was on with you, but I've heard you talking about some of the chemicals that you use to freeze your snowflakes. I mean, I couldn't even pronounce them, never mind remember what they're called. So I figured you'd got a pretty scientific brain up there.
The funny thing is too, the compound that I use for preserving snowflakes, because I don't just photograph them, I also try to preserve them as well. And basically it's a scientific superglue that you use. Its common name is Formvar, but it's polyvinyl acetal resin. And the idea to use this was created by a man by the name of Vincent Schaefer in the 1940s, I think. And there are a number of slides that that still exist that he preserved in the early 40s, which is World War II era, just about. And so those are nearby, about an 8 or 9 hour drive from here. And I've been invited to go and photograph those old snowflakes. So at some point in the very near future, I'm going to have to make a road trip and try and step back a few years.
Wow, that's like, what, 70-year-old, 60, 70-year-old snowflakes. That's going to be incredible.
Yeah, that'll be, now it's different. I mean, they're preserved as if they're wrapped in cellophane or something like that. So it's not quite as pristine as the images that I'd normally take. But it'd be a heck of a lot of fun to just explore the past and the science that still works perfectly fine today.
Yeah, well, the history on many levels is so interesting, and I think it helps. I'm not a big history buff. I don't have a good enough memory for that, but I always enjoy looking at the history of things because it helps us to figure out where we're possibly going, and that's always interesting.
Yeah, and if I can tie photography into that, then all the better.
Absolutely. So it's incredible as well that you've only been really doing photography for 5 years. Were you sort of really serious from the get-go, or did it take a little time to really sort of ramp up?
It took maybe about a year before I took the initial spark and really started a fire with it. And I was able to invest in a little bit of gear here and there that let me explore a bit more. And just like simple things like close-up filters or extension tubes or maybe a different flash, you know, whatever the paycheck coming in would allow me to spend a few dollars here and there on and to learn. And really, the more I learned, the more interested I was in it, the more science I could figure out with how optics worked or how a camera functioned in a certain way, the more I was interested in exploring even deeper within that. And so it sort of snowballed pretty quickly. Wow. My formal education is in advertising, and I was working at a boring desk job at an advertising agency, and I just picked up a very specialized lens, the ones that I use for my snowflake photographs, and we'll get into that in a second. And it was just on my lunch break, and I'm sitting around just photographing anything on my desk, tip of a ballpoint pen, staples, and pushpins, and corkboard, and all sorts of just random stuff that turned out to be pretty fascinating. And I look outside and it starts to snow. And I'm thinking, well, here's an idea. What does a snowflake look like up close? So I throw the camera up and I go out, and I'm probably well beyond my scheduled lunch break by this point. And I throw out this homemade black mitten that my grandma had made me. This is just after Christmas time, and she made these mittens. So I was putting them to good use. And so I took that out, put it outside, and snowflakes were falling on top of it. And I was just going in and trying to find one or two of them against the background. And that is still the exact same technique I use today to photograph them. All my snowflakes are photographed on that same exact black mitten. needless to say, things started to snowball even further from there. I ended up quitting my job at that advertising agency and jumping into photography full time shortly after.
Yeah, that's incredible. So you owe you say your grandma for the mitten.
Yes, but she's very proud.
I'm sure. I mean, it's like, you know, the fact that you're still using it is incredible. And you know, I was expecting that you were putting using some sort of a velvet backdrop, because they always look, the background dark black always looks so pristine. So I was thinking it was a slightly expensive, you know, backdrop, but the fact that it's just a mitten.
No. There's actually three reasons why I use that same black mitten. One of them, of course, is it's black and it offers great contrast for the snowflakes. But another one is that if a snowflake falls on the mitten, it's likely to get caught in one of the fibers. And that will lift it away from the background and make most of the background out of focus. I'll have to go in and edit out some of the little fibers that will come in. But just getting friendly with your clone tool is easy enough to do that. But moreover, it's only making contact typically on one or two different points, which means that it won't melt, or it won't melt very quickly, because all of this snowflake photography is done outside. So I'm freezing myself in order to make sure that the snowflakes don't melt. And it's happening as the snow is falling, so they just fall into place. And if I need to, I'll sometimes just nudge them with a small, very fine paintbrush and just get them onto the right angle to get the light reflecting in the proper way.
Wow. So moving on to that more, how do you, if you're breathing around these things, does your breath not, I mean, obviously you're going to be breathing, so does your breath not melt them and stuff like that? How does that all work?
You got to be careful. Mm. If it's really cold, then you don't have too much to worry about. Mm. But if it's near the freezing point, then you definitely don't want to breathe in the direction of the snowflakes because you can melt them a little bit prematurely. Mm. If you're out doing this, though, breathing when you're taking the pictures will also cause your camera to shake a little bit. Mm. And just like if you're trying to aim a gun, if you're trying to aim a camera and you're trying to get the focus where it needs to be and your depth of field is less than a millimeter, mm. then like your heart beating, you know, is possibly going to throw the camera in and out of focus a little bit. So the trick is to sort of take a few breaths and then just hold your breath as you're panning through the focus point mm. forward and backward and take as many shots as you can. I might take 100 photographs of the same snowflake mm. At every possible different focus point.
Got it.
And then I will combine them together afterwards in Photoshop using focus stacking techniques that will take, typically it's around 30, give or take a few, separate images that will add the focus together yeah. and give it in, you know, the nice proper crispness from edge to edge. And a few people ask me, well, why don't you just photograph them straight on? Because that seems like it's a lot easier. Mm. And it is. And sort of the traditional way to photograph snowflakes is about that way. Mm. But if I photograph it on an angle, I can go in and play around with surface reflection that I couldn't do in any other way. I can reveal depth if the snowflake is three-dimensional, if I'm photographing it on an angle. And that's the kind of stuff that really brings it into its own. And I can play around with light that is lit by prisms in the crystals, and you get these beautiful rainbows, or sometimes even unusual color that's embedded into the center of a snowflake created by some complex optical interference. Mm. And there's all sorts of science and physics and fun stuff when you can play around with just the smallest subjects. And I'm still getting into that. A lot of the physics and everything is still going over my head. I've got to do some research and figure it all out. And I'm discovering a lot of fun stuff just by photographing snowflakes. And so I am outside in the snow, and I've got a pretty heavy camera that's trying to do this, but it's all handheld. There's no tripod involved in this. And a lot of people ask me, it's like, well, you know, there's focusing rails and there's all sorts of macro special gear that's designed to do this focus stacking properly. Mm. Why don't you use it? And with snowflakes, again, there's sort of three reasons here. If I were to worry about focus rails and a tripod and all that stuff, then my snowflake will either blow away or it will melt, or something else will fall on top of it and smother it by the time I get the camera lined up in the proper way. Mm. So sort of time is of the essence in order to get the shot done. And I don't know, Martin, if you've ever tried to focus on a small bird flying around erratically in a bright blue detailless sky with a super telephoto lens.
Mm. Many times.
It's hard to find your subject.
Yeah.
And the same is true when you're trying to photograph a snowflake on a mitten that's entirely black, and you have no frame of reference to find your subject. So trying to set it up with a tripod means you'd be searching endlessly to get it even in the frame, and it's just an exercise in frustration. I've tried it, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. So just before we move on, I did want to remind the listeners that Don sent me four images of these snowflakes that I'll put into the blog post. The images that we talk about today will all be in the blog post, and that'll be at mbp.ac/357. But Don also has a whole bunch of snowflake photos on his website as well. We'll give you a link to that later. So,
and if I may also, Martin, if we could possibly send in a link of, I did a full Photoshop workflow. I'll send you a link to that video. It's like an hour or so long for those that are curious in the focus stacking element of it.
Yeah.
Then you can just follow me step by step, and you can sort of repeat the process if you want to tackle it yourself.
Excellent. Yeah. Send me a link for that, and I'll embed that into the blog post as well.
Will do.
You mentioned your camera and the gear. I don't want to harp on about gear too much, but it's fun to talk about it as well. So what kind of gear, what camera and lens are you using?
Well, the camera body isn't, it doesn't matter per se. I'm shooting with the Canon 1DX. Prior to that, I was using a 5D Mark II, and it worked flawlessly as well. If I was using a Rebel, it probably would have given me very similar results. So the camera body itself isn't a huge deciding factor. Yeah. in what you need, but the lens and the lighting is. Mm. And for lighting, I'm using Canon's ring flash, although any ring flash I'm sure would do an amicable job. Mm. And that's helpful because you're not worrying about holding a macro flash separately offhand or worrying about, you know, how to keep it angled in the right way, because a ring flash is very easy to operate. And so that's what's used for all the snowflake photographs. Mm. And the lens is a bit of a special piece of gear as well. Canon is the only company that makes one. It is the MPE 65mm lens, and it's a macro lens that starts at 1:1 life size and goes 5 times closer, up to 5:1 life size. And normal macro lenses will focus to infinity, so like mountains and stuff in the background, all the way up to their closest focusing point, which is 1:1 life size typically. So this lens gets about 5 times closer than the average macro lens.
I've got one of them. I thought you were that was what you were going to say.
Okay.
They're amazing lens.
And it's probably the trickiest lens that Canon has to operate. It's right up there with the tilt shift lenses and everything as far as difficulty to use. But if you get the hang of it, if you're willing to suffer through the frustrations of it, then you've got yourself a very powerful photographic tool.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people ask me, well, what can I do without having that particular special lens? Can I still do it? And of course you can. If you've got a dedicated macro lens, you can throw some extension tubes on that and you're within the realm of photographing snowflakes very easily. Mm-hmm. Very similar level of detail that I can get if you follow sort of the same post-processing techniques and all of that stuff. So a regular macro lens and extension tubes is all you'd need, even on a cheap camera body. As long as you've got the flash, you should be all set to try and do it yourself.
Yeah, excellent. It's all good stuff. So you talked about the chemical, which I can't even remember. I remember it was an acetate. So how does that come into play?
So what I do, and I've done this a number of times, is after I'm done photographing the snowflake on the mitten, I will try to preserve it. Mm. And it's always fun to have a photograph of a snowflake and then have the actual snowflake in hand.
It's incredible.
And I actually have, it's actually behind me right now, is a photograph with the snowflake embedded in the frame. I've used some of my dad's teachings, because he was an electronics technician and engineer. I built a little switch into the bottom of the frame, and if you press a button that's hidden on the bottom of the frame, it turns on some LEDs that make the original snowflake glow. So I went totally geeky on this thing.
Yeah.
But it's fun to see, you know, where things come from as far as macro photography is concerned, how small it actually is. Mm. And there's no better way than to have your actual subject framed with the photograph. But the resin, if anybody wants to try this, you can actually go out to any hardware store and buy super glue, and it may work for you. But it has to be colder than freezing in order for the snowflake not to melt. Mm. The special resin that I use, its common name is Formvar. It's a 1% solution of Formvar in ethylene dichloride. Formvar's chemical name is polyvinyl acetal resin.
Acetal. Okay. So I hadn't even got that part right.
No worries. So it's a 1% solution of polyvinyl acetal resin in ethylene dichloride. And I buy it from some chemical laboratory supply company in the United States. And it gets shipped in like 15 layers of protective barriers and packaging before it gets to me. Because I guess it's toxic or something. Mm. And all you have to do is move the snowflake. And the hardest part is actually taking the snowflake, using a paintbrush like a shovel to dig one snowflake off of the mitten, move it to a microscope slide without any other snowflake falling on the microscope slide when you're doing this, getting it in position without it breaking, and then putting a drop of this glue on top. And then you just wait a couple of hours, and the resin will cure, and then you can take it inside, and away you go. The snowflake will then melt, but it's formed around by this glue, so it doesn't change shape.
Yeah, that's incredible. I'd love to try it, but I think for the majority of people, actually getting hold of the chemical will be a bit of a difficult task, or at least too much of a pain to do. But
And that's the thing. But like I said, just try with super glue. Yeah. You might even have something hanging around the house, and if you don't have microscope slides handy, well, then just about any piece of glass or what have you, piece of plastic will work, and you can preserve the snowflakes on that. I've got a bunch of old frames that nobody's going to be. There was one frame that we had from a while ago that was broken, and it had a bunch of panes of 4x6 glass within it, and you could just pop those little pieces of glass out and use that as a snowflake catcher as well. So there's all sorts of fun you could have.
Excellent. Really, really cool stuff.
So, and there's the science part of me coming back in.
Yeah. But it's good that you know that. How did you initially figure out that that chemical was what you needed? Was that part of, have people talked about, I think you were saying earlier about the guy in the 40s. Was that the process or?
Yes, the exact same chemical was used back then. And, whenever I photograph something, especially when it comes to macro photography work, I might photograph a certain bug or a certain phenomenon. And then I go online and I research it. It's like, what kind of bug is this? What's its behaviors? What did I photograph as far as a phenomenon? I found frozen dewdrops once that had almost like a soccer ball pattern on the outside. And I was just very curious and started digging into all sorts of research on it. So when I find a macro subject that's interesting, I just turn to the internet and I start digging into it and doing the research. Probably the foremost snowflake scientist, if you can call him that right now, Kenneth Liebrecht. He works out of Caltech, actually.
Oh, cool.
And in California. And he recommended that this is the substance that you use based on this other guy from the 40s, his research. So it's sort of been going along and I've picked up on that same technique and it works as well as it did back then.
It's all very cool stuff.
It is. I should also mention, too, that macro photography is one of my biggest passions, but it's not the only type of photography that I interest myself in. The fun thing about what I do is I don't photograph people. And it's very difficult to make a go at being a professional photographer when you don't photograph people. I don't do portraits or weddings or that kind of stuff. But I do a lot of landscapes and nature photography included in the macro work. This past year, I went on two rather adventurous trips. One of them to Bulgaria and one of them to the Yukon.
Well, let's talk about that. The Yukon. It's one of those places, it sounds very remote, and I don't know a lot about the place. How come you ended up in the Yukon?
Opportunity. And my uncle is a hunter, and he likes to go on a hunting trip every year with a bunch of his buddies, and he lives in the Yukon. And so he invited me along this past year, and I said, absolutely. I'll shoot with my camera, not with a gun, but I want to be there. And so I tagged along, and this was a 3-week trip. We were spending 2 weeks in the wilderness, a little bit over 2 weeks. And if you can look at a map, if you draw a line almost northeast of Whitehorse, the capital city of the territory, towards the Northwest Territories border, that's sort of in the area that we were. It's about a 9-hour drive from the city on what you could call roads. And so it was interesting. I mean, they were hunting all sorts of animals, moose and what else was there? There's bears and everything, and people had their tags for that kind of stuff. But we were just hanging out near lakes and rivers, and we spent some time up in the high mountains. And I'm so happy that I had the opportunity to travel with a group of hunters, because there's no way I would go to this part of the world without having an armed escort next to me.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's tons of wildlife that would like to eat me. There's wolves and bears, black bears and grizzly bears. And there's dangerous places where you can go. And these animals are everywhere around you. And in fact, an adult male moose could also do you in pretty quickly as well. So you've got to be careful. Yeah. But I was traveling up there with about 5 or 6 different hunters and, spending entire days going up and down rivers and sometimes just sitting very, very still in the bushes, just waiting for something to come along. Traveling with the hunters means you have to play their game. And if you've got a photographic opportunity along the way, then you take it. And I had quite a few up that far north. We were pretty much in what's called the Aurora Belt, which is where the northern lights, even when they're relatively dim in most parts of the world, will still be overhead at night if you've got a clear night. So there was at least 5 or 6 occasions where we had a pretty spectacular show of northern lights, the Aurora Borealis. And I was able to make some time-lapse video stuff of that, and that will hopefully be coming out before the end of the year, but after I get a chance to finish editing that one up. And of course, tons of photographs. And one of my favorites from the expedition was a clear night, and I was doing a time lapse shoot. So I left the camera run for hours and hours, and when the battery was about to drain, I'd pop it out and throw on a fresh one and let it keep going. Mm. And I took 7 frames of that footage over about a 2-hour time frame, and I composited them together in Photoshop, and it makes this beautiful, it'll be on the website if you want to check it out, a beautiful display of the northern lights dancing all across the sky with the stars spinning in the sky as well. Yeah. And so it's a wonderful sort of dance of the northern clear nights and northern light pollution, if you can call it that.
It's incredible. As Don says, we'll put this into the blog post, but you can see the thing that amazes me so much about this photo. There's a number of things that, as you say, all of the stars in the sky are revolving around, I guess, the northern star. And as you say, 7 frames, and there's this one star, big star, is that Venus, I wonder, because it
could be. Yeah. I'd have to look at a star chart, but it could be a planet.
Yeah, it's very bright, and I would imagine it's probably Venus, but it's the thing that's so cool about it is that the reflection of that in the lake, it runs across along the shore of the lake, and you can actually see that the reflection of the star is brighter because of the movement of the water than the star itself. And it really, it's very cool the way it works in this multiple exposure composite that you did.
And if you look at it too, you'll notice that I did not space the photographs out evenly.
Yeah,
I spaced them out based on a Fibonacci sequence. So
the scientist coming out on you again.
There you go. Exactly. So the images, the first ones are closer together, and then they get progressively farther and farther apart. And then the sequence is modified based on which frame it fell on might not be the most aesthetically pleasing. So I'll adjust it up or down however many frames to get a good frame, and then use that one in the sequence just to give it almost a sense of acceleration when it's going through its little spiral. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, very nice.
I've taken that shot a little bit further, but one of the hazards of photographing out in the wilderness like that, especially in a cold part of the world, is leaving that camera out overnight. After a while, frost began to form on the camera and the lens and the tripod and everything around it, and all the images just became foggy. Try as I might to clear it off, it would only last a couple of frames before it fogged up again. So that shot was... the shoot, rather, was cut short. I wanted to send it out all night, but I only got about 2 hours out of it.
Yeah, we find when I'm photographing wildlife in really cold places, I'm talking like minus 20, minus 25 or so, your breath freezes on the back of the camera as well. And then you end up with your nose sticking to the LCD because it's all covered in frost. So I can relate to that. I've had my tripod all covered in hoarfrost in the past as well, and it can be a bit of a pain to work with, but it's all good fun.
It's part of the challenge, right?
It is. So you, up in the Yukon, you were there for how long, roughly?
In the wilderness, I was there for 2 weeks. And when I say in the wilderness, we have very little connection to the outside world. We had a satellite phone with us for emergencies. And I was able to make a few phone calls home just to, let people know that I haven't been eaten or anything like that. my heart's still beating. I'm still alive. But, I've got to end it because those calls are very expensive. And absolutely no other connection like that. It's the first time in my life I felt truly disconnected. And, that in itself was kind of a wonderful feeling. Because even when we were in Bulgaria, which we'll get to in a minute, when we're standing in the isolated mountains of Bulgaria, my iPad is beeping off because I'm getting emails coming in. And so there's very few places in the world right now where you can truly feel isolated and remote and disconnected. And there's a certain serenity in that too, especially when you're trying to focus just on photography. But today, if you're trying to do anything, there's a dozen things waiting for you just inches away to annoy you and distract you. And so having a certain clarity of mind to, not have any distractions and just focus on what you're supposed to be doing there. and photographing anything from wildlife to landscapes and even some macro photos. There was frost up there. I was able to get a few nights of good, clear frost, but we didn't have any snow. And, you know, of course, snowflakes are a big thing for me. Mm. I was able to take some insect photographs as well. Along came a spider when we were sitting down waiting onto a blueberry bush nearby, and I'm just sitting there. It's like, okay, well, let me just grab the macro lens and the ring flash and start throwing shots towards this spider here. And it turned out pretty cool and unexpected in that particular climate to find insects. But the photographic opportunities are everywhere. And if you're focused on it, then you're going to see that spider. Mm. And if you're not, then, you know, it might just be lost in your thoughts because you're thinking of something else and your mind is elsewhere. Mm. But because we had warmer weather, we were able to travel up into the high alpine region where we hadn't had an opportunity to get to before. Typically, we wouldn't, at least that time of the year, we wouldn't have been able to, because we would have been traveling through, you know, 2 or 3 feet of snow, and hiking up into these mountains would have been very treacherous, if not impossible. So we wouldn't have bothered. And we went up there. The hunters were after caribou. I was after beautiful shots of the mountains. and I did find them.
Yeah.
And there was one, I think it was our first night in there. We were driving around on some ATVs and following this road that led to an abandoned barite mine about, I'm going to say, a third of the way up a mountain. Mm. And so we found our way there and as far up as we could go. And then I decided, you know what? It's getting near sunset and the top of this mountain probably has the best view anywhere else. I got one shot at this. We're not going to be back here tomorrow night at sunset. We're not going to be back here ever. Mm. Let's climb this mountain. Mm. And about 10 steps in, you realize you're out of shape.
Oh, yeah.
And you've already committed yourself, right? You look back. It's like, all right, well, I've made it this far. Let's just keep going. And my knees were shot. My knees, just a small little rat hole here. A few days before I went on this trip, I was photographing an adventure race up a mountain.
Yeah.
And in this area, we've got some ski hills where I live in Barrie, or in the Collingwood area, which is about an hour away from here. And they have like this adventure race where people, you know, go through obstacles and get muddy and dirty and all that kind of stuff as they do this. And I was hired to photograph this thing, and it rained the whole day. It rained 60 millimeters rather of rain the whole day. And I was out shooting for like 12 hours and it just tore my knees apart. And so I go to the Yukon and climb up a mountain when my knees are feeling like mush. And then I realize after I get to the top, the hardest part is getting down.
Yeah.
So, and you're chasing against the sun too, because the sun is now set at this point. I've got the shot that I want. I'm happy. Mm. But if I don't get down in time, then it's pitch black and I can't find my way back to camp.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's always playing with time and playing with your own physical abilities. But when it comes down, like at the end of our little chat here, Martin, there's one tip that I want to give you about this. So keep that in mind. It's tip number one. Mm. But it also applies to when I was in Bulgaria as well. And I'd like to jump over to that for a minute if we can.
Sure.
And my fiance is Bulgarian. That's her native country. And she's lived here for the better part of a decade now. But we go back every couple of years to visit family and friends and that kind of stuff and find our own adventures too.
Yeah.
So this past trip over there, we were there for about a month. And so a good chunk of that time is going to be, you know, socializing and having a good time and maybe seeing a few sights. And occasionally, very occasionally, we were able to relax as well, but which is hard for me to do. But I had an itch to go on an adventure. And there was a couple of times that I had that feeling. And one of them, we were, I think we were driving over one of the big bridges in the city. We were in Varna, Bulgaria, which is a coastal city on the Black Sea. And there's one main bridge that crosses over a large canal. And we were traveling over to go and see some abandoned lighthouse. And I just looked down at the canal and I thought, you know what? There's a lot of beautiful lights and structures and old ships that are sort of half rusted sitting along the side of this big canal. I want to get sort of at twilight, just after sunset, I want to get along that canal and try and photograph there. Mm. So we set out, we figured out kind of how to walk there, and we were going to make an evening out of it. And we start walking down these paths, and it gets dark. And, you know, I didn't think of this beforehand, but it makes perfect sense after you notice it, is that along that canal, a lot of the property is owned by people maybe storing products or merchandise or things that generally would need to be secured.
Yeah.
So there's guard dogs present. And so we're walking down when it's pretty much pitch black, and we hear these dogs barking and barking and running up and slamming into a fence right next to us. And that was pretty scary. So we're thinking, all right, should we keep going? You know, this is, I'm with my fiance here. We've got some very expensive camera gear with me. And we are in the middle of a dark alleyway in Bulgaria with guard dogs around us. And we decide to keep going, foolishly enough. So we keep going and we're getting closer and closer to where the canal is. You can see the bridge above has some nice ornate lighting, which I'm guessing is over the water. So we're getting pretty close to it. And there are some employees leaving one of the businesses or properties that's there. And that means that the gate is open and their guard dogs can get out. So my fiance sees them first and she's like, I think that we should turn around right now. And it takes me about 5 seconds to realize she's right. And I was telling her, whatever you do, don't run, don't run. That's an incentive for them to chase after you. Just turn around, walk slowly away, and hopefully they will stop before they reach us. And we had nothing else to do but that. And we were just hoping and hoping. And they stopped maybe about 20 meters away from us. and then we just went home.
Well, that's a cool story.
And I was in trouble.
It kind of reminds me, I mean, you were talking about remote places earlier. I've just come back from a total of 6 weeks in Antarctica.
Oh, how was that?
And, it was incredible. But in fact, it was the first expedition we were in South Georgia. And you just reminded me of the male fur seals. Because those things, I've learned to hate them. they will run across a beach to come and try and bite you. And it's like I found myself a couple of times having to hold out my tripod and sort of wave it around to stop them from coming the last few meters. And I'm not sure if they would have bit me, but they sure look as though they're going to. They come up and they're all looking fierce and they're just trying to establish their territory, but... the little buggers when they
your
come
fear
across.
Is the same regardless of if they're going to stop a few meters away from you, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, they generally will back down, and even if you don't have a tripod to wave at them, if you hold your hands up in the air and shout, they'll generally stop.
It's just generally, you know, I don't like to you know, value my life on a generality.
Right,
so
yeah,
I can see the predicament you would have been in.
Yeah, it's it just reminded me of that there, but. So let's move on and talk a little bit about, I mean, you've sent me an incredible fisheye. I think this was a fisheye shot of a structure. It looks like an amphitheater or something in
yes.
Bulgaria. What's this?
Okay, so that was another adventure, one that was successful. And so the picture that I submitted is of a monument / meeting place or amphitheater, if you will, high in the mountains of central Bulgaria. The place is called Buzulja. And it's harder to write than it is to say, but it's it was the headquarters or at least a celebration center for the then Communist Party of Bulgaria in the 1980s when the Soviet Union was in power. And I think they built it in the early 80s, 1981 or so. And then with the fall of communism in like 1990 thereabouts, it was just left to the elements and to looters and it was just derelict. And locked up and abandoned. So I saw online there was a couple of great urban exploration photographers or people that just did it for fun and happened to have a camera with them that had gone into this particular structure.
Yeah.
And they said that getting into it wasn't terribly difficult. Getting to it was because there's a road that, you know, you got about a dozen hairpin turns up a mountain and we had to rent a car and drive about 2 hours into the mountain to get there. And when we get there, the gate is like welded shut, or at least it was at one point. And you could tell pretty recently somebody had gone up and cut the welds with a torch. And because I don't remember seeing rust on the place where they cut, so it was pretty recent. And then they took a crowbar to the interior doors and tore a hole in the bottom of them. And that's how you have to get in. So it was a bit of an adventure getting in. And of course, my fiance is with me as well during that little adventure. And she was none too happy about me wanting to go inside the structure, but she came along anyhow. And we get inside and it's almost completely black in the bottom, but that's not where we saw the beautiful pictures. The beautiful pictures are in the sort of dome of the structure above. So we have to wait for our eyes to adjust, and then we find a stairway and we go up. And this was just beautiful in its destruction. It was... The roof was originally made of copper, so I'm told, and that has a fair amount of value as far as metal is concerned. So a lot of the scavengers in the area have stolen most of the roof. And so you can see the light coming in, and there's some corrugated sheet metal that's not really attached to anything. It's sort of still hanging from the roof. Some of it's fallen off because the mountain's quite windy. And when the wind picks up, the entire roof rattles like it's about to collapse. So that instills confidence in a photographer that's broken in. And so I'm there, and I'm setting up to do like some HDR panoramas and to put the fisheye lens on and to just play around with all this stuff. But all the while, my heart is beating a mile a minute. The adrenaline's pumping, and I'm just watching for some shard of metal to come collapsing down from the ceiling to cut off a limb or something more important. And so we were in there for a total of about 20 minutes or so, and it felt like an eternity, just trying to get as many shots as I could before we left. And thankfully, there was no security or anything around. As far as I can tell, the Bulgarian government didn't have any funds to restore the building as some sort of landmark, and they didn't even have money to tear it down. So they've donated it as of last year to the current and not in power Bulgarian Communist Party, which also doesn't have any money to do anything with it. So it's just sort of sitting there and falling apart and decaying. And I'm not sure, like, by its current condition, I don't think it's going to be there for much longer. You know, when we were up there, there was two other couples that came by just to check it out, Bulgarian. And thankfully, my fiance speaks the language, so she's a good translator for me. And very helpful to travel in that part of the world if you've got somebody that speaks the language and is on your side. So we were able to say, yeah, we're just traveling in. That's how you get in the building if you want to go inside. And off we went, and got stopped by the police on the way back on our drive back. But it was not because of where we were going. It's just a random check. And it's kind of nervous. I don't know if you've ever been, Martin, to like an Eastern European country and you get stopped by the police on a roadside check, and then you realize your car window doesn't roll down because it's broken. So you've got to like open your car door and try and wave without arousing suspicion, but not speaking the language.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a tense moment. But
sure.
the adventures that we would have in some of those places were a lot of fun. And it's funny because as a photographer, I'm willing to go to these places. If I was not a photographer, I would not be willing to go on some of these daring. I wouldn't go to the Yukon if I wasn't there to take pictures. But I feel like I'm a better person. Like, I've lived and had wonderful experiences because of that. And I'm sure you feel the same from Antarctica. You wouldn't have gone there if you weren't a photographer.
Yeah, there's so much.
I'm putting words in your mouth here. I hope I'm right. But
oh no, absolutely, absolutely.
And I feel that traveling to this particular monument and the adventures that come of that sort of add to my life experiences, and I've got photography to thank for that. We did a little side trip as well to Istanbul, and it's just a simple bus ride. It's a long bus ride, but it's not a very expensive one to spend a few days in Istanbul, which is another Black Sea coastal city in Turkey. And we're in the Blue Mosque. I remember this quite clearly. And a beautiful structure. And I'm trying to do some interior shots, just some architecture stuff to play around. And my lens breaks. And it just completely dies. Yeah. Like, no functionality whatsoever. And I was using the Canon 24-105, which is a pretty rock solid lens. It's one of my best walk around travel lenses to use. And the only other lenses in my camera bag were that MPE 65mm macro lens and my 15mm fisheye lens. I had no other regular, you know, optical designed lens. It was just sort of specialty lenses. And this was actually a common problem. I did some research, and I guess Canon in some way has a they wouldn't admit it as a design flaw, but the lens has a ribbon cable inside that moves as you zoom in and out. And after constant use, will eventually wear out in one particular point and break the contacts. And that ribbon cable connects to the aperture assembly. So it basically makes the lens inoperable if that happens, except it worked at 24 millimeters. But as soon as I moved it to any other setting, the lens would die on me. So I came up with an ingenious way to fix this. And, you know, this is why now I bring backup equipment with me everywhere. When I went to the Yukon, I brought a backup camera body and some backup lenses.
Yeah.
But so what I would do is I would set the camera to 24 millimeters and I'd dial the aperture in on the camera to where I'd want it to be. And then I would, on the camera, I'd press the depth of field preview button, which is usually
the lens, right?
Yeah. So I'd press that button down to lock the aperture blades in place and then rotate the lens halfway off so that it's not making electrical contact.
Yeah. I've only just learned that trick myself. That's uncanny that you talk about that today. Yeah.
Okay. And so this is actually a technique you can use to reverse mount a lens for macro photography and get the aperture dialed in properly. But I needed to use it to get the lens to work, period.
Yeah.
So I put the lens halfway off and just make sure that I, you know, don't twist it too far and it actually comes off.
Mm.
And then I zoom in to where I want it to be and I focus manually. And of course, the viewfinder is going to be darker because the aperture blades are locked in and it becomes quite a challenge to take a picture. But at least I can take a picture.
Yeah.
And so I had to work through the remaining days of Turkey and Bulgaria with a completely broken lens. And that was about 2.5 weeks worth of photography done with a lens that didn't work, including that trip to that communist monument in the mountains was done with a broken lens.
So I guess you were rotating the lens back until it clicked between locations, though, right? Because
otherwise it would have fallen off. So then I have to do the whole reset process of holding down the button and spinning it halfway off and everything every time I wanted to take a picture.
That's a pain.
So, it is, especially, you know, I was hoping to do some spontaneous street photography stuff, sort of shooting from the hip and that kind of thing.
Mm.
And with a lens in that condition, it just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah,
so we'll have to make a return trip at some point with some backup gear to make it a little bit more, you know, give me a safety net anyhow.
Yeah. Well, it's always good to, I mean, I usually carry two bodies just because I like to have, different lenses on each, but essentially it means that if something breaks, I've at least still got one. And if I'm traveling by car, I'll generally have three with me. So it's, I always keep a 1D, and I used to keep the 1DS and the 1D, but now they've sort of mixed together. I've still got the 1DS, but I'll probably have my 1DX. I've got the 5D Mark III. At the moment, the DS is still my backup, but this 3D or whatever is probably going to be that will come out, and it'll be really high resolution. That'll probably be the third line that I'll be maintaining. And I just always like to keep one of each cameras in that line. And that way I can not only shoot with three lenses if I'm doing wildlife, because it, you know, that does actually help you to get the shot. It means that I've still got a fallback of two bodies if something does go wrong in the field. So it's always, it's
well,
good
exactly.
practice. Yeah.
It is. And now, of course, Canon, and most manufacturers have them now, but the Canon has the EOS M, which isn't the most technically advanced camera, but it's small. And if you're traveling light, if you're doing a lot of the backpack traveling and stuff that I've been doing, that will make, and I'm seriously eyeing it up, or whatever comes out in the same format as a backup to travel light with. So if my main camera body dies, I've got this that can still use all of my lenses.
Mm.
And give me some fairly high quality photography above a point and shoot, but I'm already carrying the lenses and other gear around with me, but I don't want to carry, say, a second hulking camera body and the extra batteries and stuff to go with that. So a smaller system. I'm looking at that pretty seriously. If Canon comes out with something that's along the quality of a 7D or a 5D packed into a small format like that, I'm on board.
Yeah.
Well, backup is important.
Unless you need it right now, I would wait on the M, because the word is that there's one with a viewfinder coming out pretty soon.
Oh, I heard that too. I've been following those rumors and I'm crossing my fingers.
Mm.
So I don't need it now, and I'm watching avidly to see what they come up with.
Yeah. There's also just been announced that the PowerShot N, which is, that looks like the sort of compact camera. I've still got an S95. And this thing is—I don't recall the specs offhand, but it's slightly bigger than the S95. It's called the PowerShot N. It's got like a 28 to 200 and something millimeter zoom on it, and it talks via Wi-Fi to your phone, and it does all sorts of stuff. It looks as though Canon are finally, for the first time in a while, actually doing something a little bit inventive with their point and shoot range. So
And there's a couple of gimmicks with that camera too. Like they're saying that you can use it any way. You can use it upside down. You can use it upside right. I don't know how many people really care about that, if that's really a feature to be promoting, but Canon seems to think so. And the only thing that I'm looking at this camera, and it looks interesting, except that they really should have gone and thrown like an Android operating system or something open source. It's got a beautiful touchscreen on the back from what I've been seeing, but it's bogged down with Canon's proprietary software. And no matter how good a camera manufacturer thinks their menu system is, it's terrible compared to what you could get in some sort of open platform like Android.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you're right, because I know that with me, the S95, that's my throw it in the bag if you don't expect to be doing any real photography camera. And that's kind of unfair because it's still a reasonable little camera, but I can't use it. You know, it's like,
I'm so used to having all of the different buttons on my digital SLR.
Exactly.
And if you give me a camera that has no buttons and a touchscreen, not even a shutter button.
Yeah.
Then I'm lost. I don't know where to go. There's no tactile feedback. Yeah. It would take me forever to even take a picture.
I can't find anything in the menus. It's just one of those things that, you know, I know what I want to do. I know that it's possible because I've figured it out in the past, but unless I use the camera every day, I basically forget where stuff is, and the menus are so unintuitive that you can't find it. So I'm totally with you there.
Right. And with the EOS, or not the EOS, but the PowerShot N, Canon is promoting this as a smartphone companion device. And I think that moniker will last a very short period of time because the advantages that they have over having a smartphone camera is disappearing within the next couple of years. And I think that this is sort of the swan song of the point-and-shoot camera, at least in Western markets. I'm sure in some emerging markets where people don't have the money for smartphones, and at least the high-end ones. We were talking about this on TWIP in one of the last episodes. There was a lot of feedback made, but I made the comment that, you know, if you remember PDAs from, you know, Palm HP, that their last swan song was, hey, we are a great cell phone companion. And then they just disappeared.
Yeah.
So I worry that Canon is putting a lot of inventive technologies and, you know, marketing efforts and teams to bring this thing to some sort of level of success, only for that to disappear in 2 years and have the technology pretty much wasted. So I'm hoping that they have success with it. And I'd really like to see something come in. But I was paying attention to a lot of the CES, you know, marketing stuff and press conferences and whatnot. And it was interesting because Fuji had just made updates to some of their smaller cameras, the X100 and I think the X10 were updated with better sensors. And in their marketing material, they were specifically saying that we're hoping that this fits into the third category of cameras. The first category being SLRs. The second category being smartphones. And then the third category being sort of the interchangeable lens type stuff, or the cameras that are very high end sensors in a small camera body. So the traditional point and shoot idea is just disappearing entirely. Camera manufacturers aren't even listing it on the map as far as something that they can make money with, and I think that's going to be a trend that continues, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, I mean it's I think. Even like I was saying earlier, that my S95 goes in my bag when I don't want to do any serious photography. But even that, now that I've got the iPhone 5 and the camera that's in there, I can still, I don't even need to take the point and shoot now if I want to just go out without a bag. And so, you know, I understand what you're saying.
I've got the iPhone 5, and I've got the iPhone as well, the iPhone 5. There's a lot of software on that not only allows you to be creative when you're taking the picture, but immediately edit it in some very creative ways, even combining some HDR stuff and doing panoramas, and then to automatically upload that and share that with the world. You've got everything in one fine, you know, condensed little package. About the only thing you don't have is Zoom,
right.
And I'm sure you could buy some sort of finicky add-on that clips into a case of some kind to get that if you really wanted to.
Well, for me though, that's the thing. I mean, that's why I would still be interested in something like the N, because, you know, having a reasonable zoom on a camera with decent optics is, to me, still going to beat the phones for a while at least. But like you were saying, I mean, over the next few years, the phones are going to continue to improve, and you know, probably their lifespan is not that long. But I generally, I mean, I every few years, these things now, you can buy the S95 for like $200. And a camera in that range, it's like, it's almost disposable in that you keep it for a few years. It'll get you some good shots that when you're stuck for your, you know, you didn't have your big camera with you, but then, you know, replace them relatively easily. So if you can get two to three years out of the N, I'd probably still be happy to pick one up. But yeah, I don't know if I will. I've not looked at the specs.
You get a good value for the time that you would keep it handy. And to that point too, like if you were to buy out an iPhone 5 and pay full price for it, that's an order of magnitude more expensive than PowerShot N or something in that same class would be. You've got to put that value in. Yeah, you might be signing a contract and getting the phone for about the same price, but in emerging markets where they don't have that luxury, they won't have the iPhone as an option, or at least not the latest version of it.
Right. No, it's all good stuff, though. I mean, it's all moving forward, and I'm sure you're right about the length of the lifespan of these new cameras coming out as well. It's probably not going to be as lucrative as Canon might expect, but yeah, you know, it's nice to see them trying at least.
And even still, I like to ground myself by saying that the most spectacular photographs ever taken, the most memorable and iconic and world-changing photographs, were taken with what we would all consider antiques today.
Yeah, for sure. Anything we've got now is better than the stuff that we had a few years ago, so we're all in a good place.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we talked earlier, you mentioned that you'd got some tips for us. Can you just throw out three tips, photography related tips, if you can?
Well, we've kind of gone over some of them in a roundabout way, but I'd like to spell them out. I was reading, this was probably a couple of years ago, I went into a used bookstore and they had a bunch of old photography books. And one of them was National Geographic, The Photographs. And it's a beautiful hardcover, big book, gilded edges. You know, it was a really fancy thing. And I only picked it up for a couple of bucks and figured, you know what, let's read through this and figure out the history of photography with National Geographic. And it was an interesting read, but there was one line in there that really stood out for me. And they asked one of their photographers, how do you take great pictures? You know, like, what is your secret? What do you do in order to get the shot? And the guy just shrugged and said, F8 and be there. And that line just really stuck in my head because, you know, it really abstracts everything to do with the camera. It doesn't matter what gear you've got. It doesn't matter what settings it's on. It matters that you're in the location at the right time and that the camera is an extension of your own body.
Yeah.
Because the settings don't matter. You'll figure them out when you're there. It's just being in the right place at the right time. And that inspired me last year. One of my favorite shots of last year is a beautiful bolt of lightning stretching across the horizon of my home city here. And across the waterfront. And it's a great shot. But I had to get out of bed, drive across town in the middle of a thunderstorm, set up my camera and take the shot without any knowledge that I would actually get it. It was just luck and chance and stupidity to stand in the middle of a thunderstorm with a gigantic metal pole. But I got the shot.
Yeah.
Because I was there. And ironically enough, the shot was taken at F8. But I just look at that and I think, okay, well, I went to Bulgaria and I traveled to these places. I specifically went on these adventures for photography. If I just hoped for the serendipitous moment to come across me, I would never get these images.
Yeah.
I would never have gone to the Yukon. It doesn't matter what camera I had with me, and it doesn't matter what settings those cameras had. It matters that I was there. And it's helpful too to abstract. I mean, look at all the money that people spend on gear.
Yeah.
You know, I've got the 1DX and so do you, and that's a multi-$1,000 camera. Right. It cost me around $7,000 Canadian.
Yeah.
Where could I go in the world for that amount of money?
Yeah.
Pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and I could take any camera with me to whatever place I want to have in the world, and I can take great pictures. And so being there and getting yourself to the proper place and going on that adventure, I think, is just get yourself somewhere interesting. That is tip number one.
Mm. Great tip.
And tip number two would be, the world is not 5.5 feet tall. Don't just stand. And I see so many people, they've got an absolutely fantastic subject, but they just stand there, put the camera up at eye level, and they take a snapshot. Yeah. And afterwards, they tell people, well, you had to be there. You know, the photograph doesn't do it justice. And that's because you didn't explore the scene enough. Yeah. You didn't try different angles. You didn't try a different point of view. Throw a fisheye lens on your camera. I love using those. Or a macro lens. Or put the camera down on the ground and point it up. Or hold it above your head. Try to find a different point of view than the point of view that everybody else sees, because you can be pretty much guaranteed it's more interesting.
Yeah.
So that's tip number two. The world is not 5.5 feet tall.
Yeah.
And tip number three, I would say, is tell a story. And this is something that's very difficult when you're not photographing people, because you have to have some sort of connection to a subject. You've got to look at a scene and tell yourself, okay, well, what is my subject? And how is that subject interacting with its environment? What does it do if it's alive in its daily life? You know, what would it encounter? Can I add that to the frame? Or if it's, say, a plant, where does it, you know, how does it live? It gets the light from the sun. So maybe I get a low angle and get the sun in the frame and sort of tell a story with a plant. Or how do I take an animal and find it in an environment that tells a story about its life? It's got to interact with another animal, maybe. And where can I find that? So telling yourself what story it is that you want to tell with a picture, and then trying to get that story told instead of just taking the picture and hoping something materializes. Just try to pre-visualize something and get a story to come out of that photograph, some connection with the subject matter. And you know what? Oftentimes you can't do it. There's no stories to be told with my snowflake photographs, for example, but they're still fascinating pictures. So you can't do it all the time. But if you can add that element in, then it makes your photograph a lot stronger.
Absolutely. Very good tips. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, Don. And where can people find you online?
Well, right now, in the wintertime at least, I'm doing my Snowflake a Day project on Google+. So I'm editing one snowflake photograph every single day for 100 days starting December 1st. And you can find that on my Google+ page, and you'll find a new one every day. And I teach workshops and I do all sorts of other stuff. Like you, I do a lot of printing too, and you can find all the information about all of my pictures on my website at doncom.ca. It's doncom.ca. And that links to everything else as far as Facebook and Twitter and anywhere else you can find me on the internet.
Excellent. So, don't forget to send me a link to that video you were talking about, and I'll embed that with a few other links into the blog post. It really has been a lot of fun, Don. I've found myself chuckling to some of your comments, and of course being enlightened by a few of the others, and I've had a great hour sitting here talking with you. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Martin. And you know, if anybody's listening to this and they've got any further questions that they want to ask, by all means, send me an email, get in touch with me. I'm more than happy to answer anything that anybody's got. So don't be afraid to give me a shout. I'll be here.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
So thank you very much for listening today. Remember that you can find me too on Google+ and Twitter, and all links are at the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode, but in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.